Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Welcome to Conversations. My name's Trent Dalton, sitting in for Richard Feidler. He'll be back with you on Monday. My guest today is Paul Stanley. The first time Paul Stanley held his son Matthew in his arms, it was in a hospital labour ward on January 23, 1991. And in that moment, Paul reckoned he was quite possibly the happiest man alive. 15 years later, Paul was again holding Matthew in his arms. This time, he was kneeling on a footpath outside a high school party. And Matthew was unconscious. His brain was injured. Matthew Stanley died the victim of an act of youth violence. The kind of act Paul Stanley has spent the past 5 years of his life fighting. As head of the Matthew Stanley Foundation, he spends his days visiting schools across Australia and the world, telling his story in the hope that one day there will be an end to youth violence. Paul Stanley, thanks so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
Paul, how does the Matthew Stanley Foundation work?
Well, basically, after Matthew was murdered, there was a whole lot of people sort of were saying, you know, we've got to do something about all this rubbish that's going on out in the world. And so there was a lot of people sort of got together, young people and old people, and we said, OK, let's do something about it. And then we started struggling to work out what the something was going to be. And it's just, I guess it's a little bit like a snowball rolling down a hill. It's just evolved from the horror of Matthew's death. And, yeah.
Let's talk about where that snowball first began. Matthew was your oldest son, but he wasn't your first child.
No, that's right. Yeah, we lost our daughter. She died at birth, and we were told that there was no way that we were going to be able to have children again, and, you know, so to be looking at adoption and all that sort of thing. And that was on the 6th of January, and 1 year and 16 days later, a miracle happened.
An absolute miracle. Do you remember the first time you saw Matthew's face?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just wonderment, you know, to sort of be able to realise that he was part of us.
What sort of baby was he?
He was one of these kids that he was just no drama at all. He used to sleep for hours, and he used to think that he was dead, and he would just sleep all the time. And, you know, when Kay and I would bring him into bed with us, you know, he was the one who would lie north south and not move all night and everything, and it was just remarkable. And he was just a generally good little boy.
What did this beautiful baby grow into? What sort of teenage boy did he grow into?
He grew into a teenage boy. He was very, very intelligent. He was very bright at school. He got busted once for stealing when he was at primary school, and what he was stealing was books out of the Year 6 library because he'd read all the other ones in the other libraries. It was quite remarkable. And, you know, he was good at sport, and he was just a genuinely good kid.
He's one of these kids that had a wonderful spirit about him, a spark.
Yeah, well, he as he got older, of course, he was definitely his own man. There was no doubt about that, and he didn't suffer fools gladly. And you know, I think I came into that heading as well many, many times, but I've been told since that that's pretty normal for a teenage boy and his father. But no, I mean, he had a huge circle of friends. I mean, he counted a couple of teachers from the Redlands College where he goes to as his friends, and that's pretty remarkable for a young fellow. And yeah, he was a good kid to be around.
is a great older brother to your youngest son, Nicholas.
Yes, I've heard since that there was the typical getting a thump around the ear old from his older brother for Nicholas and that sort of thing. And but they got on pretty well indeed.
Paul, how did you guys spend the day before that fateful 18th birthday party?
I really and truly don't remember because it wasn't all that remarkable. It was we were actually celebrating Nicholas's 12th birthday, and you know, I seem to remember Nick had some friends around, and it was a pretty low key sort of day. I mean, and Maddie was going to a party that night, and we decided that we'd go out and have dinner, you know, a family dinner before dropping Matt off at his mate's place. And yeah, we it was really funny that the four of us went to this restaurant in our town, and I think one part of it, we had a food fight, and I think I won, actually, which would be the first food fight I've ever won in my life. But and it was good too, because Maddie didn't complain at all night that you know, we were holding him up from going to the party or anything. And it was almost like it was preordained that it was going to be just a beaut night, and it really was. It was just wonderful. And you know, little did we know that in a few short hours things were going to change.
You and Kay, your lovely wife Kay, drove Matthew to his friend's house that night.
Yep.
How did Matthew say goodbye to you?
He leaned in the car and pulled the hair on the back of my head, which he used to know drove me up the wall, and just as he walked away, just a big wave and said, "See you later, Dad." That was it.
It's a wonderful moment and a wonderful sign of affection. It's the way we males sometimes show we love each other.
By punching each other, yeah.
Of course, these were the last moments you saw your son conscious.
Yep.
Do you recall what you and Kay spoke about on the way home that night?
Yeah, it was funny. Actually, there were three of us, and Nick was in the car as well. And I remember we just sort of said, Nick, Matty, I mean, well, Nick, of course, is a good kid, but we just said, isn't Matt just a good kid, isn't he? He really is nice, and underneath everything, you know, there was that lovely marshmallow. I guess you could say that about him, that, you know, he... And we were just yarning about what a good kid he was, and how lucky we were to have two fine kids like Matt and Nick.
You guys went home. Where were you around 10:30 p.m. that night?
Well, I was watching television. Nick was on the computer, and Kay was in bed, and it was just a normal Saturday night, and the phone went, and Nicky answered it and yelled out that Charlie was on the phone. And now, Charlie was one of Matt's friends, and we knew Charlie through touch football, and we were family friends and all that. And I walked over to the phone, and Charlie said, I just said, how are you going? And he said, look, Matthew's been attacked, he's been bashed, and he's really sick. You better get here right now. So we did.
What scene did you confront when you arrived at the party?
Well, we drove round into Brompton Street at Alexandra Hills, and there was police cars just all over the place with the lights going and police everywhere, and you know, there was all the kids who were at the party were sort of getting herded into little groups where the police could take, you know, names and telephone numbers and everything, and lying on the side of the road with the lights of a couple of cars shining on them was Matty.
What'd you do, Paul? What does a dad possibly do when he sees his son in that state?
Try and understand what the heck it's all about. I sort of knelt down beside him, and and he had blood coming out of his ears and his nose and his mouth. And just tried to talk to him. But he was unconscious.
What were you told by the ambulance officers about his state?
When the ambulance finally arrived, the guy ran over and shone a torch into Matty's eyes, and I can always remember he just said, "Oh my God!" And I told him who I was, and he just said that Matt's really sick, and we've got to get him to hospital. So they did.
You're listening to Trent Dalton. I'm sitting in for Richard Feither this week. Paul, you followed Matthew in the ambulance to the hospital. You arrived before the ambulance. When you were allowed into the ICU room, what did you see there?
Well, prior to actually going to the Princess Alexandra Hospital, into the ICU room, we'd been sitting in the waiting room, and the head of the ICU came down with a neurosurgeon that they brought in, and they showed us the discs that they'd, the x-rays that they'd taken of Matthew, and they showed that he had two fractures to his skull, four broken ribs, had a crushed lung, and they said Matthew has horrendous brain injuries, they're irreversible, and he's going to die. And that's all it was. And yeah, naturally I didn't believe it. Because these sort of things just can't possibly happen to your own kid or somebody that you know. It's always some random 15-year-old kid who got bashed at a party. But, and as a thing I always use, i.e., but the Broncos are playing well this year, because it's not real. And even then, when we were able to go up to the ICU and we walked in, and Matty was just lying in the bed with a tube down his throat and wires hanging off him, and one of the remarkable things was that he wasn't bruised or anything like that. I mean, you see these pictures on television, somebody's been bashed, and then normally they can't see and their faces are black and everything, but he just looked like he was sleeping.
Such a beautiful boy, just sleeping. When did you finally know he was gone? When were you able to convince yourself?
About 3 weeks ago.
5 years and three weeks ago.
About then.
What happened 3 weeks ago, Paul?
knock on the door. There was a knock on the door and Matty wasn't there. I guess it's hard to explain. I mean, it's always... let's put it this way. I don't think any parent ever can really consciously grasp the fact that their kid's not there any longer. I mean, Matthew's bedroom was still the same way as it was when he left, probably nearly 2 years. You know, I don't even think the bed was made. I never went in there. But that was going to be a room that would never be used for anything. I tried sleeping in there one night. Kay and Nicholas were away for the weekend at a friend's place, and I thought, OK, I'll get rid of some demons, so I'll hop into the bed and sleep there the night. I didn't get rid of them. I got a whole lot, I can tell you that. But we've now turned Matty's bedroom into the Mat Cave, which is my office.
The Mat Cave. What demons came to you that night? I mean, did things suddenly come flooding to you?
Look, they come flooding to me all the time. I mean, even now, you know, it's nearly 5 years gone, and it's still, he's still there, you know, and I can see him lying on the roadway. All those horrible things.
Some incredible decisions yourself and Kay had to make on the night in that hospital. You were approached by a donor coordinator.
Yeah, we were approached. I don't know whether it was day or night. I mean, it was. I can't remember if there was a window in the room he was in, but we got asked whether or not Matty was an organ donor or was going to be, it was funny, we'd been having this sort of conversation with Matt a few weeks before, whenever, because we were talking about when he got his driver's license, how you can put a tick in the box and, you know, if you get killed, well, you know, you can donate your organs. So we thought long and hard about it, and when Nicky sort of said, well, you know, when Matty will be dead to us, but, you know, he'll live on with other people and that'd be cool. So considering that he was celebrating his 12th birthday by watching his big brother die, you know, it was a pretty remarkable thing to do. So
what an amazing sign of maturity from Nick.
Yeah, it was. It was, I mean, I don't know whether or not he really and truly could grasp what was going on. I mean, I couldn't, so I don't know why he would be able to. But, you know, when we made the decision that we were going to allow Matty to be cut up into little pieces and sent all over the country, you know, it was a heck of a decision to have to make. And but we did, and we were, I mean, we were happy that there was going to be some good that's coming out of all this rubbish that was going on around us. So at least he was going to be an organ donor. That was cool.
There's always amazing coincidences surrounding such tragedies like this. You go back over the conversations you had with Matthew, and one of the remarkable ones would happen to be where you asked him, what would you do if you were asked to be a donor?
Yeah, well, I think his answer was a pretty teenage sort of thing. He said, "Oh, yeah, Dad, you're dead. You might as well help somebody else out." And that was, I mean, and that was his idea that it would never happen to me. It's one of the things that worries me, that the people just never ever think that it'll happen to them. Even parents I talk to, you know, they're, yeah, I'd be all right. It'll be, everything will be okay. But it only takes one split second for that okay to turn into something horrible.
For someone to give that remarkable gift of organ donorship, the body needs to be remaining conscious. How hard was it for you and Kay and Nick to leave that ICU room that night?
When Matty was finally declared to be brain dead, it was, I don't know, it was night, sometimes 6 o'clock or whatever. You know, I guess I wasn't looking at a watch. But we stayed with Matty for a while, and, you know, the hard thing is to make the decision to stand up and walk out, you know, knowing that you were never going to see him again. And but, you know, we finally gave him a kiss each and walked to the door, and I turned round, and the last sight I'll ever have of Matty is him lying there and he was breathing. You know, and this was because they had to keep pumping oxygen into his body to keep all these beautiful 15-year-old organs good.
Outside the room, of course, there were possibly 130 of his friends. I mean, you didn't ask them to come up. They came up of their own volition. A wonderful tribute to Matthew right there.
Well, yeah, that's right. It was, I mean, there were kids who were at the party, and there were just kids who weren't there. I mean, and the wonders of modern technology, I mean, within, you know, 30 seconds of Matty hitting the ground, I mean, the whole world knew about it because they were having to text each other and everything. And there was, I don't know, 130, I think somebody counted one part of it, they reckon there was 200 people there. And it was just, and they were just sitting there and not knowing what to do, I kept coming out and telling what was, where things were up to, and that Matty was still alive, and somebody said to me, "Oh, can I go and see Matt?" So we started to take them groups of 5 and 6 to go in, and all they'd do is just walk into the room and stand there and cry.
Of course, because how does a teen deal with death?
Well, again, I don't think that that most of the kids sort of could consciously realise what was actually going on. I mean, I suppose to the fact that Matthew was so totally unmarked, you know, like he wasn't bashed and battered or anything like that. He was just lying there, and if they'd taken the tube away that was pumping the oxygen into him, he would have just looked like he was sleeping. And I don't think the kids really and truly were getting their heads around it. And, as I say, I certainly wasn't. I mean, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe that he was going to die. And even though we've been told that was what was going to happen. But, yeah, it was just wonderful support from Matt's friends. And, you know, the teacher, the headmaster from the Redlands College came up, and the chaplain from the school came in. People everywhere.
How do you possibly go home from that and live any semblance of a normal life in your normal home?
Well, I think the thing that helped us, start to get a handle on what was happening was, I mean, the first person that was around on the Monday morning was one of Matthew's teachers. And Rodney actually conducted the funeral service as well. And, I mean, people just started coming around, and it was quite amazing. You know, they would arrive around with a box of tissues, and there were heaps and heaps of tears, but within 10, 15 minutes, there'd be raucous laughter happening because they'd start talking about, all the funny things that have been happening with Matt and funny things that he did and things we found out about. And you go, oh, I see. I thought he was doing science. And then find out that he'd actually gone into the Acker and something like that. And that lovely photograph he had taken with that girl was actually taken on the train. It wasn't taken in somebody's lounge room. You go, like, yeah, right, okay. But it was bizarre that, you know, you were talking about our dead child, and it goes on forever.
It was almost as if you were discovering this hidden life of Matthew's, that he lived, you know, away from his mum and dad, this one of this amazing young man who touched so many people's lives in that community.
He certainly lived two lives, there's no doubt about that. There was the obligatory teenage boy who drove mum and dad up the wall and everything, and then there was this beautiful kid who used to go and see people and put a smile on their face.
How did you come about choosing the church for the funeral service?
Well, it was... We got a letter from the pastor from the church there, David Gronenboom, and it was just, he mentioned that a lot of Matty's friends were going down to the church and just feeling comfortable down there and listening to music and that, and he said, if there's anything I can do to help out, just give us a yell. So, you know, Kay and I are getting a new string to our bow. We're organising our son's funeral. Great. You know, that's not something that anybody becomes expert at, but we went to the cemetery at Mount Cotton, and there was a nice little chapel there that held about 100 people, and thought, we better check out this church. So anyway, we went down there, and it's a huge church, really, isn't it? I was talking to David, and I said, how many people can fit in here, you know? And he said, I think it was 380 or 480 people seated in there. He said, we can put closed circuit television in the next room. They can sit on the floor. And I'm going, I said, hang on. You realise we're talking about Matt Stanley, you know? I mean, he was like 15. I said, you know, that won't be that many people coming. He said, oh, don't you believe it? And I said, you're the expert. And he said, no, I'm just a preacher man. And so now this preacher man... is a very, very close friend of ours and has been very helpful to us.
You have a wonderful relationship with that preacher man. Tell me your journey. He's a spiritual man and at a time when you were really battling with your spirituality.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not a religious person. I believe that there's got to be somebody up there that's looking after us. But I used to find that just, you know, being around David was so comforting. And, I'd be driving down the road and go, hang on, and then I'd turn around on the road and go back and sit in the church or sit in Dave's office and, contemplate. And I can always remember one night there was, emailing all around a number of different people and carrying on a conversation. I ended up by saying, look, I've just had enough of it. I've got to have a beer. I'll talk to you guys tomorrow. And David sent this little message through saying, I'll see you in 10. And 10 minutes later, there's a knock on the door, and I walked out. Then he's the preacher man with a six-pack. I thought, wow, this is what preacher men are really all about.
That's right. Human nature right there.
Yeah, he's just a remarkable man.
It was at Matty's funeral, Paul, where I guess you really resolved to do something about stopping youth violence.
Yeah, Trent, I think, I mean, I wasn't going to say anything. I mean, Kay had spoken and Nick had spoken and some of Matty's friends had got up and spoken. And Rodney, when he sort of looked at me and, you know, gave me a, are you going to say anything sort of look? And I, okay, fair enough. And because we'd been sitting, of course, at the front row, and Matty's coffin was about a metre away from us, and, you know, I could almost reach out and touch it. Anyway, I thought, I better go and say something rather than I walked up and I went onto the sort of the stage thing there, and I looked out into this audience, and there was just, the room was just full of young people, just mainly young people. And they were just all crying and trying to get a handle on it. And I thought, no, this ain't going to happen again. Not while I've got 2 feet on the ground and my head above the ground. You know, we've got to do something about it. And it was just sort of, you know, the thing was, what is something going to be? And I guess then when we had sort of, I suppose it was a wake at the local soccer club that Matty played for after, and there was all these kids. I mean, it must have taken me two hours to get from the gate, the 25 metres into the clubhouse, because all the kids wanted to talk. And what are we going to do about it? We've got to do something. And yeah, it just, you know, it was a little snowball that just got bigger and bigger.
Were you ready to do something? Were you physically ready?
Oh, I have no idea. It's sort of a thing that it's easy to say, yeah, let's do something. But then if you'd asked me then to tell us actually what is going to be done, I wouldn't have the faintest idea. You know, I mean, you could call a public meeting, have 1,000 people there and screaming out 1,000 different ideas and nothing gets done. I don't know when it sort of became, well, okay, right, let's put together a whole group of people and do something, and it just happened.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
I'm Trent Dalton. This is Conversations. My guest today is Paul Stanley. His son Matthew died at a teenage birthday party, prompting the Matthew Stanley Foundation Against Youth Violence. Paul, the Matthew Stanley Foundation, where is it at now? And the journey from 5 years, it's a remarkable journey from that moment, a bunch of well-meaning teenagers, to something that is truly making a difference to teenagers' lives.
Yeah, well, I mean, the good part about it, there wasn't only teenagers, I guess the kids themselves. I mean, as I always say to kids, you know, I look at, when I'm giving a presentation at school, I look out in the audience and I see Matthew's face in every one of them. And their thing really was to make sure that that we did something. I don't know what the heck something was going to be. We've got to do something to try and make sure that we don't have to go to teenage funerals again. You know, it's horrible. It was suck it and see, I guess.
That day you made the vow to end youth violence at Matthew's funeral, could you possibly realise that you would be revisiting the worst day of your life, potentially on a daily basis?
Well, if I'd thought about it then, I probably wouldn't have started doing what we're doing. As you say, it's reliving that horrible, horrible day over and over and over again. But I guess that's the strength of the message.
That's right. I mean, that is really what the teenagers connect to, isn't it? Any school you've gone to, they are often still and quiet as you are detailing that story.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, the number of times you get a pre-apology from the headmaster or the teacher who's running and saying, oh, they're a bit, you know, the kids are a bit of a bunch of rat bags and that, and they've got the attention span of a Besser block and all those sort of things, you know, and, you know, they'll be standing up walking around the room, and the only time people stand up and walk around the room normally is if they're getting up and walking out because they can't, you know, they're being so affected by Matthew's story.
Did you feel you were channeling your one anger and grief into the work of Matthew Stanley Foundation?
Well, yeah, I suppose the short answer is yes. I don't know that there was any conscious decision of how we were going to do things, and I use the term we because, you know, while Kay doesn't come out and speak in schools or anything like that, you know, her support is paramount to make sure that I can do it. I mean, I basically stopped working. The guy that was working with us, who was my, you know, best friend.
What is your day job, Paul?
My day job is going into schools and talking to young people. But previous to that, we have a business that we put protective coating on vinyl and timber flooring. So, and Craig said to me, he was Uncle Craig to Matthew and Nicholas, and he said, mate, look, you know, I'll just look after the business until you're ready to come back. And that's what he's done for 5 years.
You mentioned Kay. You threw yourself into the foundation. How was Kay coping in those early years?
Obviously very, very hard. She wasn't handling things well, and that's justifiable. I mean, she's already lost two children, and I think that it, I would be right in saying that it probably affects women harder than what it does, well, the mother harder than what it does the father, because, you know, I mean, they had the pleasure of carrying the child for 9 months before, you know, dad gets to see the kid. And it wasn't until a wonderful friend of mine who happens to be a journalist came around and spoke one day to myself, and then Kay came involved with it because we'd been down to Matthew's gravesite, and he just happened to ring up on that day. And when he came round, he managed to get some words out of Kay that sort of she was able to get some, you know, some of the rubbish off her chest.
Every moment, every song, every film, every piece of food in the fridge is a trigger.
Yep. Surely is. The it was funny. Matthew's favourite song was "Forever Young." It's a beautiful song, and that more than anything is it just triggers me right off. I mean, I was going up to Mackay for the very first to Townsville. I mean, sorry, for the very first time to speak in a number of schools up there, and the plane landed, and the captain of the plane said, as we were taxiing, he said, "Oh, I'll just put a little bit of entertainment on for you." And I used to be able to have the song "Forever Young" switched off when the second note was played, and I was sitting right down to the back of the plane, and he put, the song that they put on was "Forever Young," and I just cracked up. I, you know, it was a gibbering wreck, and I could see people look at me going, "You know, what's with the old grey-headed old guy over there sitting there blubbering away?" And, you know, I couldn't escape. I couldn't do anything, so I had to listen to it all the way through. And when I got off the plane and, you know, went down to pick up the bag, the police officer, a lady, was there, and Bernie and I had never met. We've spoken on the phone and that, and she looked at me. She said, "Oh, you okay?" And I told her what had happened. She said, "Wow, isn't that really great? You know, Matty's with you." I went, "Oh, okay, I'll work on that."
What a way of looking at it.
Yeah, sort of. Yes, it was, I mean, it was his song. Because I always remember him saying, I said to my, "Beautiful song, isn't it?" And he said, yeah. He said, "Look, Dad, I like it because, you know, I don't ever want to grow up. He said, who wants to be old and grey like you?" He said, "I just want to be young forever." The trouble is, he got his wish, and that's, you know, you'll be 15 forever.
You're listening to Conversations. My name's Trent Dalton. I'm sitting in for Richard Feidler this week. Paul, do men grieve differently to women? Do fathers grieve differently to mothers?
Well, I don't know that I can answer for Kay or for mothers. I guess from a father's point of view, I mean, I was looking at all the things that he was going to be when he grew up, and he was, you know, hopefully that any of the good things I was doing as a father that I'd, you know, got from my father, that he was going to be able to carry on with his kids. And, you know, when he became a father I don't sort of know the answer to that question because I don't know what it's like to be a mother. I'd be a very wealthy man if I was, I guess. But I think the thing with a man and a woman when they get married, most times, you know, the woman takes the man's name, and the man's meant to be the big strong one in the family and the breadwinner and all that, and you look at your son and go, "Well, I just hope that you do a good job for when you become a father and a husband and a father and that." And I don't quite know what mothers think. That they probably realise that no girl's good enough for their son. So I don't know the answer to your question.
How do you like to remember Matthew on his birthday?
As extremely intelligent young man. He was a good-looking kid. but this not something from his birthday, but I always remember earlier on in 2006, Matthew was really keen on playing touch football, and we went to the schools tournament, which was a selection trials for the Metropolitan East in Brisbane here thing. And, you know, being 15, he didn't want to have anything to do with me. It was all right for me to drive him down to the tournament and everything, but, you know, don't come around me, you know, because you'll embarrass me. Anyway, obviously I watched all the games and that, and he had a good tournament, and then all the kids were called together, and the names of the people were read out who'd made the side. And, you know, heck, there's what, something like, I think 27 schools in our area, and you say, well, okay, 27, and the number of kids who play touch football are probably, you know, 300 or 400 from all the different schools. You multiply that out, and so to make Met East is a pretty high honour anyway when it came out that, you know, Redlands College number 7, Matthew Stanley, and of course everybody cheers. And he just, I didn't even realise he knew where I was. And he turned around and just looked at me. And I thought, yeah.
Paul, why is a punch such a natural reaction for a teenager?
I suppose a lot of the problems or the reason for it is now that the young people are starting, they're so hands-on with everything. They play, for example, they'll be playing a computer game, and it's an instant reaction. I would see it very difficult for you to get a 15-year-old kid into a room like this and get them to bang on for an hour, because they lose concentration after about 15 seconds because there's nothing happening. And I think that it doesn't have to be just a violent game that the kids are playing to get this instant reaction. It can be a car racing game or anything at all, but they've got to have this instant gratification. And I think this is what's coming into the way young people are carrying on now. Instead of being able to sit down and talk something out, you know, they don't walk away and chill out. They just react to it immediately. And I think that, unfortunately, we're just seeing more and more incidents where a person has reacted like in a second, instead of just, as I say, walking away and chilling out and calming down and say, hey, that really wasn't too much of a problem. You know, the guy didn't mean to actually bump me and spill, you know, 1 millimetre of beer out of my glass. You know, that was an accident. When he said sorry, you know, that should have been accepted. But unfortunately, a lot of times now they turn around and go whack, and then turn around when there's blood coming out of the person's ears, when they're lying on the ground, they say, oh, sorry, I didn't mean that to happen. Well, it's too late then.
Did you ever find out why Matthew was struck?
Oh, the guy was a thug. He'd been causing problems at the party while it was going on, and he just decided that, yeah, Matthew was a good target.
Paul, how many teenagers do you estimate you've spoken to in the past 5 years?
Well, just going back, I mean, we've never written down, but going down and saying, oh, you know, there's 500 in this one and 1,000 at this school, etc., it's somewhere up around about 135,000.
What do you hope to get across to them?
The fact that, as I just said there, you know, it's too late to say sorry when it's happened. I mean, just walk away from a lot of these situations and chill out and calm down and come back and just go, hey, look, you don't want to be in a situation where the person they're talking about is your best friend, that he's the one lying on the road, or she's the one. And that's the scary part too, because there's a lot of young women who are getting terribly, terribly violent. I just hope that we can get the kids to understand that sorry doesn't cut it when somebody's lying on the roadway.
How do you manage to get through to them? How do you not make it just another adult preaching to a teenager?
Well, I guess how we started off, I mean, first of all, we get asked to go into the schools. We don't go out and promote going in there. The schools have heard the message that's going around. I started off by, we run about a 4.5-minute little DVD of one of the radio, television stations' news reports and that, and then I basically say, hi, I'm Matt's dad, and I just tell him everything that happened right from the time of going to the restaurant and having a food fight and dropping Matty off and then pulling my hair and then being told that Matthew had horrendous brain injuries, the irreversible, and he's going to die. And I go right through, and all the time in the behind me, we have the Matthew's photograph keeps coming up all the time, and just go right through until, you know, I was holding Matty's hand when he died, and trying to get across to the kids that, you know, it does actually happen to normal human beings, to real, real people, and it's not just a random 15-year-old that got bashed at a party, but the Broncos played well, you know, as I said that before. It's and I suppose, too, it's the fact that I'm talking about my son. I guess, Trent, if you went in there and you said, oh, this guy that I know, his 15-year-old son, went to a party and he was attacked as he was leaving and he got bashed and he died next day, they'd go, ho-hum. Yeah, terrible, isn't it? But I can see the kids, you know, looking, you know, every nanny, and they keep looking up at Matthew's face as it scrolls over in the background, and they realise, hey, this old guy up there, it's actually his son he's talking about. And it is real.
What are some of the things they say to you after they've heard your message?
I was at a school a few weeks ago, and they'd actually had five separate incidents in the morning. And they said, oh, you know, if you're in the area, can you come in and have a talk with the kids? And I said, yeah, okay, fair enough. And I walked into this room, and there were five people in there. There was four girls and one boy. And it was quite remarkable, you know. I think, you know, this is the ratio, you know. Anyway, there was this one kid sitting there with the feet up on the desk and everything, and hat on backwards, and you know, the reels just slouching like a normal teenager does. And I thought, what do I go up there and kick the chair out from under so she'll take notice that, well, that's probably the wrong way to go about an anti-violence message, but. So anyway, I started talking, and she gradually she took her feet off the desk, and then she took her hat off, and she sat up and everything. And at the end of the talk, she came home and said, can I talk to you? And she had tears coming out of her eyes, and she said, I was going to have a fight with a girl after school today, but I'm not going to now, because I never really thought about what could happen. So, yeah, I mean, maybe she'd have a fight with this chick the next day, I don't know, but at least she didn't that day. So yeah, just sort of hope that... You know, that's the sort of message that we hope to get over.
Maybe that's one life changed.
Yeah. Yep.
How do you speak differently to a girls' school and a boys' school? You just mentioned girls' violence. I mean, yeah, what do you say to a girls' school?
Oh, exactly the same. Exactly the same if I'm talking to kids in year six as well. You know, I just say the same message. And I mean, I had one headmaster said to us one day, I don't think we'd be getting you back. And I said, why? And he said, it's not fair on the young people. You know, it's too dramatic for them to listen to. And I said, what? The fact that my son, who's about, you know, like 4 or 5 years older than them, got bashed to death. You know, if they learn it now, maybe they won't. They won't actually go out there and create havoc and kill somebody. I mean, I don't care. I don't care if I upset people.
The way you have been able to cut through to teenagers, it's really spreading around Australia and in parts of the world. But you've been asked now to enter into prisons, talk to young teens, spread that message even further.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think people are starting now to acknowledge that the fact that there is a major problem out there. And schools are saying, hey, look, before they used to say, we don't have a problem at school here. And then I kept saying, well, yeah, you might not have it at school, but when they walk out the front gate and go out for the weekend, you know, that's when you've got a problem. And we've got to put that message out there. We have yet to go into the prisons, the system. It's work in progress at the moment. But what they want to do is to get us to go and talk to these young people who are in there to just actually say, hey, look, you know, you're lucky. You only bashed the guy and you only broke his jaw. This is what could have happened. And, you know, in any way at all that we can get a message out there, just keep on doing it.
Paul, you've just returned from New Zealand, your homeland,
yep.
Particularly Christchurch.
Yep.
What's the city like?
Absolutely devastated. You can't get an idea of what it's like seeing it on television. I mean, towards the central part of the city. They have the red zone over there, which is an area which is totally fenced off, and nobody except engineers and actual workers are allowed to go in there at all. So the whole of the heart of Christchurch is just shut down. Everybody who had a business in there, they're operating from their own houses or, you know, wherever around the suburbs and that. And the roads are just so bad that, I mean, you're lucky to be able to drive at 30 kilometres an hour. It's like driving over a, you know, corrugated iron fence with holes in it and everything. It's just, you know, it's horrible. It really is. A very good friend of mine, she was, we were there last weekend at her place, and she's gone from a vivacious 50-year-old into a lady that looks about 75 because of these constant earthquakes and that. And she just, you know, she just was crying. She said, "I just wish it would go away. Just leave us alone." And you know, these poor people are putting up with this all the time. And they say, "Oh, yeah, but you had it really bad in the floods." I said, "Yeah, but the floods are gone." And oh, there's another earthquake. You know, and that's the thing. They're getting shocks. You know, I think it's about 8,000 earthquakes they've had and aftershocks. You know, and just people will walk into a supermarket and they'll look, and I got told about it, and then I was able to actually to witness it. They'll walk into a supermarket and they'll look down the row to see where the item is that they want, and they'll check out what's on the top of the shelves, and then they'll go at 100 mile an hour and grab what they want to get and go, because they don't want to be caught between the two rows in case there's an earthquake and they get dropped, you know, a carton of soft drink gets dropped on their head.
Did you have any relatives of your own that were affected?
Well, my brother lives over there, and he's lucky because he lives on the western side of the city. And if you at his place, you would wonder, what's this earthquake they're talking about? You know, you feel aftershocks in there, but there's no very, very little damage around there. But as you get closer to the centre of the city, it's just, I mean, there's churches that don't exist any longer. The Catholic Basilica, the big dome they had on there, that's dropped, and you know, half the building has just crumbled to the ground. It's just horrible.
Trent Dalton sitting in for Richard Feidler. Paul Stanley is my guest. Paul, you mentioned your father before. What was your relationship like between you and your dad?
I guess similar to any teenager and their father. My dad was just such a special person. He was one of those people that I remember the company that he worked for. I ended up by working there as well. It was a stock and station agent. And Dad never, ever used to sign a contract with farmers. He'd just say, oh, you know, buying the grain off them, the grass seed or whatever, and he'd say, oh, okay, I'll give you whatever, you know, $2 a pound or whatever. And that was the agreed price. And when I started working in the company, you know, the farmer said, oh, you're Alex Stanley's boy. I said, oh, yeah, great, okay. And they'd want to deal with me, and I was the office junior. And it was, he was a man, if he said something, you knew that that was what was going to happen. And it was just, he was just such a wonderful man, he really was. Yeah, and he and Mum followed and supported my brother and I. Whatever sporting endeavour we did, they were there for us all the time. I mean, and I just hope that I could take, if I could take half the things that my dad did for me and pass those on to give them to my children, I reckon I'd be a pretty darn good father. And you know, our dad was wonderful. He really was. Hard as nails.
Well, I was going to ask, you're one of the most affectionate men I know. You give anyone a hug, no matter who they are, really. Was your dad like that?
Well, no, he wasn't. He didn't have a good childhood. His father actually died when he was very, very young. And later on in life, Dad's mother married this gentleman whose name was Stanley. And the kids all took the name of Stanley. So Dad's name actually was Charles Alexander Knee, which is quite an unusual name. There's not many Knees in New Zealand. I hate it when I say that. But, yeah, and so my father this passport actually shows Charles Alexander Nee, also known as Charles Alexander Stanley, and we became the Stanley family, and so did their family. But Dad was never able to hug anybody, and he would stand there with his hand right down by his side. Well, I'd give him a hug when we got off the plane after coming back from Aussie even on holidays, and then I'd say, "Oh, you silly old goat, give us a hug," you know, and "Oh, okay," and then he would, but. He certainly loved Michael and I, Mike being my brother, and he would do anything for us, anything at all.
We've spoken about Kay and Nick and their journey. How are they going today?
Kay is getting better and better. Nicholas is going through the 15s, 16s. And he's actually pretty lucky at the moment. He's looks like he's got an apprenticeship in air conditioning with a company here, which and the guy that he'd be working with is only 25, so they're near enough in age as to be mates and that, and to be able to get an apprenticeship in these day and times is pretty cool. But poor old Nicky, last year he had a full shoulder reconstruction because he got his shoulder dislocated four times, and then the surgeon said, "Oh, you know, we better do something about it." And then, blow me down, but 3 weeks ago he was away on the school skiing trip for the year 12s and dislocated again. So, poor fella. But if this apprenticeship all comes through good, it'll be great for him.
Paul, you once said to me, "There's a light at the end of the tunnel, but right now there's a bloody big train running through that tunnel." Is the light getting any clearer?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I at least can go to bed at night and not have it not be lying there every night at 2 o'clock in the morning and having these demons jumping up and down on my head. So I guess things are becoming a little bit easier to handle, and so that train is probably not driving quite so fast now as what it once did.
Where to now? Where do you take Matthew Stanley Foundation?
Just more of the same thing, I guess. I mean, we're now changing the focus slightly, and we're doing a thing called, I might have just casually slipped it in before, Walk Away, Chill Out. And the idea is to actually give young people something to do in between this situation is getting out of hand, what am I going to do, and somebody lying on the ground bleeding from their ears. The idea is to make it cool for them to be able to walk away and chill out. For people to accept, "Oh, gee, I'm sorry, mate, I didn't mean that to happen," and accept the fact that that somebody says sorry. So it's we keep on looking at different ways to put the message out there, and like Redland City Council are getting on board with what we're doing too. And that's pretty cool as well, to have a whole city turning around and saying, "Well, we want this to happen." And also there's a number of smaller towns around southeast Queensland which are taking the Walk Away, Chill Out thing on board, so it's good.
The message is getting out there.
We hope so.
Paul Stanley, it's been an honour and a privilege talking to you today. Thank you very much for coming in.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Conversations on ABC Local Radio. You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.